Chapter 34, Roshan's Bargain. Juliana had watched from the gate down to the Undercity for some time. Twice she had retreated back down the tunnel to avoid the dragon's passes as it raked to the ground with dragon fire. None of the strikes had been particularly close by, but Juliana knew little of the dragon's abilities and limitations and took precautions as she passed. She had heard the crash of the great beast as it was brought to the ground amid a residential district on the wealthier side of town, nearer the cliff wall. She heard the shriek of pain and surprise, the crush of stone, and various other debris being flung about. Juliana rushed back to the gate entrance and saw wings flexing and flapping, as if to test them after the dragon's fall. She heard the smaller gout of flame sent down the street and saw the light from it, though she could not see the flame itself. Highlighted against the small fires burning in the city, she saw the dragon crane her head and looked westward. Juliana hunkered down in the entryway, trying to avoid attracting the dragon's notice. Something was going on. The dragon had ceased her attack and was just looking out to the plains. With the dragon so near and the great bellows of dragon fire being spewed forth, Juliana was too close to massive shifts in the ether to have noticed Roshan's arrival. She watched the dragon in rapt fascination. With a closer view and the dragon still, she could see what a beautiful creature it was, sleek, graceful, and majestic. Her musings were broken when the creature turned suddenly in her direction. Juliana ducked and pressed herself against the stones of the arched gateway, but the dragon paid her no heed. Jade fire extended her wings, and with a great heave, thrust herself aloft, wings raising a cloud of dust and debris as she cleared the site of her tumble and gained altitude. Juliana got an excellent view of the dragon's underbelly, a slightly lighter shade of the deep green scales about the rest of her, as the beast passed over her toward the top of the glacier. She heard a great crunch of snow and ice as the dragon settled above her location.
"I hope the wall can hold her weight, along with that of the ice and snow," Juliana thought.
Iridan ached. He could move, that much of him worked at least, but that was the most he could credit himself with. He remembered the layout of the city well enough that he would be able to find his way to the mine entrance easily enough. That was not the problem he faced. Actually, it was two and perhaps even three problems rolled up into one giant problem that he was preparing to deal with. He had exhausted himself, body and source, in the battles for the wall. He was only now feeling up to drawing ether again, should he have to, and it seemed that he would have to. He could walk and possibly even jog a bit, but his aching muscles probably did not have a run in them. If it was to be a race to the mine entrance, he did not like his chances. Once he got there, he was to stop the human trader who had taken up with the goblins. It seemed safe to assume that the goblins had not taken on the least sorcerer they could find among the Magrin, so he was expecting to face a true foe when he got there. Iridan was slouching in a chair in the sitting room closest to the castle's door, where the soldiers assigned to oversee the retreat of the downed sorcerers had been bringing them. The sitting room was littered with spent sorcerers. Two of the lesser circle sorcerers were laid out on blankets, unconscious, possibly dead. Caldrax was about, but he was up and alert, seemingly having withdrawn himself from the battle before his last energies were spent. If any of the goblin forces breached the castle entrance, it was comforting to Iridan that someone, at least, was fit to put up a resistance. Phelan was laid out on a chaise, unmoving. He rose to take water when the servants brought it, so Iridan knew that he was at least still living. As for Iridan, he was neither in the best nor worst shape of the lot of them, but he was the one who had received orders directly from the warlock of the Empire himself, and he was the one training to follow in the way of the warlocks. Iridan forced himself to his feet and stretched his back, working out the stiffened muscles that had settled into unhelpful places as he recuperated. "Caldrax, watch over them," Iridan ordered, making clear his intent to depart. I have a task from the warlock. There is a sorcerer trying to reach the upper mines. I must go stop him.
You seem in no condition, Caldrax said. Do not waste yourself in combat in your current state.
The older sorcerer looked haggard when Iridan turned to look at him, and scared.
I suppose he would rather I was here to defend this part of the castle instead of just him alone, Iridan thought.
Instead, Iridan chose not to answer at all, but made for the castle's front entrance. The guards obliged when he ordered the portcullis opened for him, despite the fighting that grew nearer by the moment. The Cadran troops were fighting a slow withdrawal action, never holding ground at too great a cost, but making the goblins pay for their advance every pace of the way. Iridan's back groaned in protest as he ducked under the portcullis. The guards had lifted it just enough for him to pass beneath. The streets were deserted in the immediate area of the castle, but did not seem as if they would remain so for long. The fighting was close by and growing closer. The chittering cries of the goblins and the screams and yells of the Cadrans mixed together with the sounds of steel striking steel and occasionally stone. There was light of a sort, but it was haphazard and not nearly adequate. The fires of collateral damage were too far and too little, and the starry sky drew dimmer as the smoke from those fires wafted upward and became thicker. Iridan switched over to ether vision. Roshan had warned that the sorcerer was camouflaging himself, so even in good lighting, it seemed a better bet to watch in the ether than in the light. His ether vision was keen enough that he could make out the streets and buildings by the disruption in the ether's flow, so he worried but little about stumbling blindly. As a bonus, it allowed him to keep an eye toward the advancing goblins' infantry as well, and keep clear of them. The entrance to the mines was not far. The castle was built largely into the north mountainous wall of the city, just a short way from the defensive walls. The entrance to the mines lay between the two, the primary concern of the original lords of Rainsdark, who were no dukes in those early days, and the primary reason for the construction of the walls in the first place. The gold of the upper mines was the life's blood of Rainsdark in those bygone days. Iridan saw the mine entrance as he hurried, not quite jogging, but rushing his steps at least. The mine seemed undisturbed, with no excess traces of ether to suggest that someone powerful of source had passed there. The entrance was of stone timbers, with runes all about them, like much of the old preserved architecture of the city. There was a pair of rusted iron rails running out from it, which had been less well preserved. There was no debris or refuse kept in the mine entrance, and it seemed well preserved, though Iridan knew not why.
If no one has passed through yet, I am in time to stop him, Iridan reasoned.
He found a small civic garden a few dozen paces away and crouched behind a hardy evergreen shrub. The shrub's own source was unimpressive, but it was the strongest of the meager plants that the Rainsdark folk grew, and large enough to hide him from light, as well as obscure his source some. He began to hold back his ether to husband it for the expected battle, as well as to disguise its power. He had not long to wait, as he saw a pair of sources coming from the direction of the wall. One was a lizard of some sort, being used as a mount. The other was his prey. With neither parley nor warning, Iridan struck from ambush, loosing a bolt of ether with most of what he had held. The blast was considerable and silently cast, one of the spells Iridan had first learned to cast in such a manner. He took the head clean off the lizard that the sorcerer rode, and the sorcerer himself was thrown to the earth some paces distant. The invader's shielding spell had shattered, but had saved his life. Iridan had eschewed such defenses himself, lest they be seen by an alert foe before he struck. With surprise lost, Iridan quickly saw to his own defensive shields, quickly armoring himself silently in ether. The Magrin sorcerer was no fool, though, taking the initiative and attacking immediately, even before seeing to the replacement of his own shields.
Kolo Ketenshu Mafira,
Still lying on his side from where Irdan's spell had hurled him, the Magrin sorcerer made a claw-like gesture down. Irdan was unfamiliar with the spell, but learned the gist of it quickly enough when the ground turned liquidy beneath his feet. With no magic ready to support him, Irdan sunk quickly into the soupy soil. A second gesture, the complement to the first, solidified the ground again, with Irdan stuck chest deep, his arms trapped below the surface before he was able to raise them. Irdan drew as hard as he could, his source aching with the effort. The Magrin sorcerer was already launching into a new spell, and Irdan needed to do something or he was going to be a stationary target for it.
Hakvia Golotanu Deshai Ekalamu,
the Magrin intoned, drawing himself to his feet. Irdan knew the spell and diverted all the ether he had just drawn into reinforcing his shield construct. He hoped it would be enough. His adversary formed a sphere with his own two hands, and within drew a distortion in the air. Once it grew to the size of a wheel of cheese, it shot forth, crossing the distance to Irdan in the beat of a swallow's wing. Jinzan watched in satisfaction as the apprentice in warlock's garb was torn asunder, the top half of his body gone to gore and splintered bone where it had once protruded above the soil. Satisfied that he had no further opposition, Jinzan rechecked the contents of his pockets and headed into the mines. There was no light within, so he quickly made one for himself, not trusting to his ether vision. He had no map of the mines, so he needed to be alert for any signs of his direction. The goblin advance was proceeding well, but since the arrival of the demon,
is it truly Rashan Solaran, or just a descendant?
He would bet no amount on their chances, let alone the success of his whole mission.
Your little ones are doing poorly, demon,
Nihash Dukali commented, gazing down at the city far below. She and Rashan stood upon the crest of the Neverthaw Glacier, the only flat spot around that offered the vantage of the whole battle that they were looking for. Despite her protestations against the cold earlier, the dragon was thankful to be able to bury her maimed forelimb in the ice to soothe the shooting pains it gave her. The icy cold on the rest of her seemed a small price now for such relief. Perhaps, Rashan answered, speaking draconic. But we will not settle this until one side surrenders or is wiped out. I have trust in my followers. He was not 3 paces from the dragon, each on guard against treachery by the other. Despite his fears of the mighty beast, his mind tangled and untangled plots of how he might slay it, bargain or no. The dragon knew that Rashan's magic was formidable, possibly able to cut through her nigh impervious scales or even affect her monolithic source itself. She also knew that the demon was quick afoot and might well dodge claw or tail or even dragon fire as he worked his magic against her. For his part, Rashan knew that the claws and teeth of the great dragon were little concern to him. His physical body was a tool of his source, not the reverse, and despite horrifying wounds, he would be able to fight on. The dragon fire was his real fear. While fire was a power that had many counters in the ways of magic, dragon fire was mostly ether, born on flame. It could cut through wards and stone alike, and burn things that no other fire would harm. Caught in a full blast of it, he was almost sure to perish. Even his shields could not withstand more than a short or incidental burst of the stuff. What Nihash Dukali did not know, however, was the true nature of Heaven's Cry. His boast about Lorimar was the first gambit he had made in his thoughts of bringing the dragon down. When she claimed never to have heard of the necromancer, whose few score winters of prominence could easily have escaped the notice of the ages-old dragon, he knew that she must have been ignorant of Heaven's Cry as well, for their tales were interwoven too closely. Sadly, it would not be so easy to kill a dragon with the blade. Its poisons would not do much to dragon scales, certainly not quickly enough to make use of in combat. Getting Nihashtukali to inhale the vapors might work, but that was an uncertain ploy. He needed something better before he would strike. He might only get one chance. With the dragon's withdrawal, the goblins pressed the attack, no longer fearing the collateral carnage their deity was wont to inflict. Brannis had seen Jadefire fly up to the glacier and had noticed Rashaan following shortly thereafter.
When did he arrive? And what is he scheming at?
Brannis wondered when no sign of fighting broke out between the bloodthirsty demon and the green-scaled force of nature.
I do not know how he got the dragon to stop attacking, but I like our chances better against the army of goblins than against that beast.
Fall back! Reform ranks! Brannis shouted.
With the dragon out of the calculation, the battle could be fought on Kadrin terms, no longer dodging around buildings to keep out of the path of the dragon fire that had claimed all too many of Duke Peloton's men already.
Sir Garen, take command of the north half and have them fall back to the castle. I shall hold the main gate to the Undercity.
The fighting was chaotic. The goblins were still equipped with climbing claws from their initial ascent of the mountainside. Now that the battle was being fought on the streets, the goblin soldiers were taking advantage of the urban terrain and scaling the walls of buildings to gain advantage on the Kadrins, who were staying at ground level. A spear clanged against the side of Brannis's helmet. The wards on the armor prevented him from even feeling the blow.
How many times over would I have died today had I been armored as my knights? The soldiers wear just mail, and the militia just what they have for sturdy clothes.
Brannis saw the goblin whose spear had sought him on the third-story balcony of a nearby house. Brannis dug Avalanche into the ground and gave a flick of his wrist. The irresistible blade uprooted paving stones and flung them skyward in a spray in the direction of the spear thrower, who ducked back inside the building. Brannis paid it no mind and turned his attentions back to the organization of his forces. The Kadrins were reforming, but slowly. The goblins outnumbered them badly and were taking their toll on the scattered human fighters, sealing off many pockets of defenders and hedging them in, cutting them down. There were enough, though, that two fronts could both make disciplined retreats back to the castle and Undercity gates, respectively. Brannis stood at the fore of the retreat, keeping a wide swath around him clear of invaders. The goblins were no fools and made every effort to avoid the gold-armored purveyor of death, covered in much blood of their kind. Spear and shield was a slow fighting style, easy to defend with, and wearying to push back.
Numbers. It was all down to numbers, as the Kadrin soldiers could only hold out so long against exhaustion and the cold.
Cold was one ally, however, that Brannis could not afford to underestimate. The goblins were a thin, wiry people, with little insulating their bodies. They wore heavy, for them at least, clothing, but they just did not generate the kind of body heat to keep a pace with the rain's dark nightfall. They fought like crazed animals, knowing this. It kept their bodies warm, and it drove the humans farther and farther toward the warm security of the sheltering Undercity. Once the goblins took the fighting underground, the cold would no longer hamper the scrawny invaders. Yet minute by minute, the goblins advanced, despite Brannis's best efforts to hold them back. Brannis moved up and down the line of spearmen, forcing the goblins back anywhere he found a spot weakening against the onslaught. He had lost all track of time once the sun had set. Fires burned here and there still from the dragon's attacks, but the battle was being fought largely by moonlight. The endless horde of goblins seemed to pour out of the dark nothingness beyond his vision. A score would die at his feet, and from down side streets and around corners came more. Brannis knew rationally that there was an end to them somewhere, but he doubted whether they would see it.
Ka-thoom!
Brannis and two men behind him were thrown clear of the front lines by cannon fire. The artillery had arrived. Iridan vomited all down his chin and chest. With his arms trapped at his sides beneath the dirt and held upright, he could hardly manage otherwise. He saw nothing of his torso, and just a gruesome half-man left buried in the soil just beneath his head. He ached throughout, especially the parts that were not there anymore.
"It's not real. Pull yourself together," Phelan spoke quietly, yet harshly.
The illusionist wiped away the tableau of gore and blood he had painted over the stricken Iridan. "It fooled that Magrin, at least. Now let us get you out of there." Phelan looked pale and moved stiffly, but seemed alert and in command of his power. Iridan tried to turn to see his fellow sorcerer, but could not turn anything below his neck. Phelan saw his struggle and moved to Iridan's front. He looked down at the trapped apprentice warlock and smiled reassuringly. He poked Iridan in the chest, clothed again in his black tunic, trimmed in red and gold, and entirely there. "I promise, you are not dead." Iridan shook his head to clear it. The world sounded a little fuzzy and muted. Phelan sounded a long way off.
"Ears," he mumbled.
Phelan took Iridan's head in his hands and turned his ear toward the half moon for better light. "There is some blood. You shall likely feel worse for this, but you have lived through it," Phelan assured him. Iridan only believed the part about feeling worse. "I do not have much for spells to undo this sort of thing. If you have any strength left to lend aid, start moving earth." Through a series of small telekinesis, the two began to unplant Iridan from the soil. Juliana cried out in shock. She had heard the cannon fire and saw Brannis disappear from view. She had been watching him the whole time, but did not see where he ended up. The fight was drawing closer to the gate, and she resisted the urge to rush out to his aid to see if he had survived. She suspected he had, wearing that fabulously enchanted armor Warlock Roshan had outfitted him with. But there were limits to all magic, and she hoped that Liad's armor had not found its own.
Kathoom!
Juliana saw that the goblins had discovered Grapeshot when crushed paving stone clattered against her shielding spell. The spell held, but the soldiers nearby had not been so well protected by their armor. Juliana saw that the men who had hung by the gate, along with her, were largely gone, bleeding their last upon the stone roadway that led down into the bowels of the city.
"Time to end this vigil and shut the gate."
"Get inside," Juliana shouted. "I am dropping the portcullis."
A short way from the gateway, there was a heavy wooden door from whence the guards controlled the workings of the portcullis. She rushed inside and saw there was no one within.
"Must have been among those killed while watching the battle," she assumed.
There was a crank like a ship's wheel, with handholds all around, and beside it a lever. If she were to pull the lever, it would release the catch that kept back the weight of the portcullis. The whole thing would crash down, and any who were caught on the wrong side would be trapped at the mercy of the goblin army. Back to the doorway, she poked her head out and watched as the Cadrans withdrew to the safety of the undercity side of the gate. They did not flee, but gave ground and kept back the goblins from following them in, at least as well as they could. When she saw that the line held right at the entrance, she went in and gave the lever a great heave. It took all her weight on it to move the handle, but it was enough, and outside she could hear the great iron grate crash down into place, separating the two armies. She collapsed against the doorway in relief, watching to see the Cadran defenders and goblin invaders jabbing through the bars at each other with their spears. Suddenly the goblins pulled back and scattered. The Cadran defenders did not react in time, but Juliana dove back within the gate control room.
Kathoom, 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 kathoom.
Metal shrieked and groaned. Screams of iron and men mingled, and a light rain of rock fell from the ceiling of the passageway. Juliana peered outside and saw that there was a hole in the portcullis, large enough for the goblins to run through three abreast. She quickly pulled the door closed behind her and barred it before they got around to doing so. There was a second door within the control room on the far side from the one she had entered from. She opened it and rushed through. She caught herself immediately, though, grabbing the door jamb before she slammed into the next wall, not a full running pace away. The door had led her to nothing more than a garter robe, put in place for the soldiers stationed at the gate. Juliana could hear the goblins pouring through the ruins of the gate, driving the surviving human defenders before them. She ran back across to the outside door, still barred and as yet disregarded by the goblins, and pulled out one of her daggers.
Frantically, she carved the runes of a protective ward on the wood of the door.
It seems your army is retreating underground, demon,
Nihash Dukali observed, chuckling, a deep bass that was felt
through the warlock's whole body.
Why, yes, I had noticed, you great reptilian town crier.
The dragon's eyes were far better than his own, but Rashan wagered that his ether vision was stronger. He used it nearly constantly and saw what befell in the gateway and just before it, where the dragon's eyesight was blocked by rock and snow. Nihash Dukali most certainly could see the ether too, but through so much dead earth, he doubted she could watch what he saw. Those toys your tinkers made have done admirably, Rashan commented sweetly, trying to keep the contempt out of his voice. He had not found a weakness to exploit, and the battle was going toward the sewers, both literally and figuratively. His eyes played along the scales and curves of the dragon's form, watching the interplay of muscle and sinew from her fidgeting and deducing the anatomy beneath.
Why do you keep looking at me, demon? Nihash Dukali demanded, suddenly suspicious.
She brought her head down level with Rashan. The great dragon's nostrils were at his head height, her fangs longer than his body. It was beginning to occur to her that the demon was much too small to be a threat physically. If she could just wait until she could draw up all the ether in the immediate area, starving him of magic, she could have her chance to destroy him. I have never seen a dragon before, let alone so close up. Pardon me if I cannot help myself marveling at your beauty. Would the ancient gods had taken so much care in crafting humans, Rashan said. It was commonly held that dragons were vain creatures, and his musings on their beauty had enough truth to it that he hoped it assuaged Nihash Dukali's suspicions.
He had not worked magic since they had taken up their vantage on the glacier.
His source, ever industrious, had been supplying more than his body required for that whole time. His normal habit of siphoning that excess off into multitudes of tiny magics had been put on hold, and his reserve of ether was growing. Soon he would either have to find his spot for an ambush, or find a way to begin venting off that extra ether without Nihash Dukali noticing.
Brannis spat blood, nauseated. It was not his own. Whomever had fallen atop him had only done so from the collarbone up. It took him a moment to gather himself once he realized he had been blown clear of the immediate fighting. Falling among the corpses, he had been ignored by the goblin forces. It would seem that they trained their soldiers well enough that they did not stop mid-battle to plunder. Brannis wished he was sensitive enough to tell if the warded armor was depleted. He could barely believe the blow he had just survived, both the initial impact and slamming into the western cliff wall of the city afterward. He was still mashed against the rock, blood dripping all over him. Gagging at the mess and smell, he turned onto his hands and knees.
Where is it?
Brannis wondered, not seeing his sword about. He looked to see if it had driven itself clear into the rock, but found no hole to mark its entrance.
It must have been knocked loose when I was hit. When I dropped it.
Realization dawned, and Brannis remembered the nature of avalanche. He looked up and found the sword hanging in the air a few paces back the way he had flown. Looking back that way, he saw that the portcullis had been blasted through, and goblins poured through into the undercity. Of the defenders at the gate, he saw none. There were cannons being wheeled through as well, interrupting the flow of troops as their heavy carriages were maneuvered through the ragged opening.
I have got to put a stop to this, Brannis thought. There is no one around. I have to find a way to bring the avalanche wall down.
Brannis looked to the sword, hung from nothing, waiting to be reclaimed.
Time for you to earn that name of yours,
he silently told it. The sword accepted the news stoically. Avalanche was not too far from the corner of a house, so Brannis used the building as cover, and then sneaked up and made a short leap for the sword, pulling it out of the air. Goblins took notice, but those who first took notice were quickly dispatched with a swipe of the blade. After that, Brannis ran off, ducking behind the houses and occasional shop that formed the neighborhood around the gate. Goblins continued streaming down the main trade road, making their way straight from the main city gate, recently destroyed, to the undercity gate, even more recently destroyed. Brannis made his way to a more remote section of the western cliffs and searched for a handhold. Climbing had never been a hobby of his, even as a boy, but this was a circumstance that demanded risks be taken. Keeping Avalanche drawn and ready, he found twofold purpose for it in his climb. He was able to use its irresistible blade to carve spots for hands and feet to grip, and more importantly, he was able to let go the hilt and use it as a brace, trusting that the armor that could hold back a cannonball could protect him from the blade of Avalanche as he leaned on it. He made slow progress up the side of the cliff. Goblins below noticed before long and threw spears and tiny daggers at him, but all bounced off Brannis' armor to no effect.
Were those hitting wards, or was that the metal turning those blades?
For Brannis' plan, it would be very useful if the wards had not exhausted themselves. At length, Brannis made it to the base of the avalanche wall and carefully walked along the narrow flat area before it to the gate, to the undercity. Goblins took note of him, but he was beyond the reach of their thrown weapons, and out in the cold, by himself, when there was a war and warm air to be found in the city below. Brannis seemed to be better left to the attention of someone else. Brannis managed to keep free of interference as he steeled himself to do the craziest thing he had ever considered. Taking Avalanche in both hands, he leaped and swung the blade flat first through the wall in a great diagonal slash. He felt the barest of resistance as rocks shattered at his sword's passing. Without waiting to see the results of his handiwork, he hopped backward, off the cliff, leaving his sword out in front of him to drag through the rocky cliff face all the way down. Above him, Brannis heard the groan and crack as rock, snow, and ice shifted and began to fall.
Downward he plummeted,
rolling and turning to try to fall with the sword aside him rather than risk falling with it atop him or him atop it. The resistance of blade and stone was minimal, but slowed him from being fully in free fall. The remains of the portcullis bent and then shattered as the sword caught it. After that, it was the duration of a blink before Brannis slammed into the road on his side, crushing goblins beneath him. Brannis was stunned by the fall, his left arm exploding in pain where it was caught beneath him.
So much for the wards, Brannis mused.
Then the Neverthaw Glacier fell atop knight and goblin alike, dropping 100 feet of snow and ice across the entrance to the Undercity. Rashan had tensed as he watched Brannis inch along the avalanche wall, rune-forged blade in hand.
Clever boy, do it. It is the chance I need.
When Brannis' blade breached the wall, the city's protection against the Neverthaw Glacier gave way. The glacier shifted and began to fall, the support it had relied on for countless generations suddenly no longer sufficient to hold back its awesome weight. The dragon panicked. She and Rashan had been watching their forces overrun the undercity gate below and bringing siege to the castle on the north side of the city. All was going in the goblins' favor. Then, without warning, the ground began to give way beneath them. The dragon's instincts caused her to stiffen her forelimbs against the falling motion, even as she unfurled her wings to slow her fall and take flight. But in that short moment, she seemed to forget the demon she had been holding vigil over. Rashan did not hesitate. He had spent his time with the dragon mapping out her muscles and scales, finding where best to strike if the chance was presented. He could tell by the expansion of Nihashtu Kali's chest as she breathed where her lungs ended. His ether vision saw the shielding construct built around her and where he could penetrate it. She was an impressive beast, but a middling sorceress, and he had his pick of spots where his own magic could whelm hers. Rashan aimed his strike just behind her left forelimb as she extended it to halt her slide. On a human, it would have been a strike aimed roughly at the chink most armor had beneath the arm. Dragon scales were not so clumsily assembled, but they faced the unnatural strength of a demon. Drawing Heaven's Cry and lunging with a two-handed grip in one blinding action, he sent an ether blast to his target ahead of the blade. The magical attack weakened the dragon's shielding construct just enough that Rashan's strike was able to drive the point home. The rune-forged sword punctured dragon scale, and Rashan's blade plunged to the hilt. Unleashing the terrible magic of his creation, he pumped all his stored ether through the blade. The sword was lodged in Nihashtu Kali's left lung, and the plume of toxic fumes not only filled the dragon's lung, but melted through it, eating away the heart and other lung as well. Nihashtu Kali screamed, or tried to at least. The great bellows that had earlier announced the doom of the Kadrin forces now choked off in strangled agony, accompanied by a billowing cloud of the noxious vapor that had been forced into her. The dragon's pain was short-lived, though, as it was already a corpse by the time it pitched face first into the snow, ensuring that the avalanche would take the whole glacier with it. With the dragon's added bulk, there was no stopping that. Rashan rode the dragon's corpse, hanging onto the blade until they had nearly reached the ground. Before the impact, the warlock leaped free of the monstrous, dead sledge. It was a gleeful, liberated demon, drunk with bloodlust, that fell amid the teeming masses of goblins. It was a stake thrust into history, with Rashan Solaran's name upon it. Dragon slayers were the stuff of storybooks, not histories, for dragons resisted slaying like no other creatures. The mantle of Dragon Slayer would fit nicely among his boasted titles, Rashan thought. Out on the streets of Rainsdark, and afterward on the plains below, goblins died, and died, and died. Juliana heard the immense thunder of the crash and felt the ground shake as if the whole of the mountain would come down atop her. She heard the frightened goblins running down the passageway and then the relative silence that followed. She put away one of her daggers and risked unbarring the door. Outside, the corridor was clear. Magic lit it, left by some goblin sorcerer most likely, and she saw bodies all about, mostly human, some goblin. At the gate entrance, she saw the whole of it blocked by fallen ice and snow, some of it forming a slope back into the corridor. Here and there, a limb or a spear or a bit of shining metal shone through the debris. She caught a flash of gold. Brannis! Juliana rushed over, heedless that any goblins backtracking to the entrance would have her trapped. She put away her other dagger and rushed over to begin digging in the snow with her hands. Brannis! Brannis, can you hear me? Juliana asked.
Oof!
Came a muffled response from beneath the snow. A minute's effort had revealed Brannis's face. Once she knew better where he was, Juliana drew ether and warmed the snow around him. She pulled off one of the vicious gauntlets of his armor and took him by the hand with both of hers. She heaved and pulled as she melted the snow that pressed down on him, slowly dragging him free enough that he could help the rest of the way.
Thank you, Brannis said, collapsing on his back to catch his breath.
Juliana plunked herself down beside him, sitting in the melted runoff and not caring. Brannis unclasped the demon helm and pulled it off, and his hot, sweaty head steamed in the icy air.
You stopped them, she said.
Good. Any idea how many got through?
Too many. They are overrunning the Undercity by now. Not many of your troops were left to hold them off, Juliana said.
Brannis looked at her and saw the concern in her eyes. She knew that he was not going to give up, take his rest, and leave the defense of the Undercity to those with more left to give. Brannis sat up and cupped her cheek in his ungloved hand. He leaned over and kissed her. The snow had cleaned much of the gore from him, albeit haphazardly. He looked nothing like the heroes drawn in the fairy stories that Juliana had grown up worshipping. He was bruised and bloody, with matted hair and dripping sweat. But he was everything she ever really wanted in a hero.
I have to go help them.
I cannot just rest here, much as I might need it. If I think too much, I might not be able to move at all. Brannis grinned ruefully. He took up his helm and put his gauntlet back on. Avalanche was lost somewhere amid the snow, and he had no time to look for it. He took up a discarded spear from the floor and headed down toward the Undercity. Stay here, or at least stay back. I have to go. It was all she heard, all she ever heard from Brannis anymore. The rest did not matter. She would follow. She would never stop following him, unless that phrase changed to, I want to go. The Undercity was in chaos. Goblins were everywhere. The Kadrin defenders were few, and civilians were all over. Some reinforcements were arriving from the castle, but the castle defenders had been hard-pressed as well. Brannis looked about and saw that there was no organization to the defense. If there were commanders about, they had been overwhelmed by the maelstrom of flesh and steel. Minon's plan was the only solution Brannis could think of. The ogre pins were along the south wall of the Undercity, and well away from where the civilians and their defenders were making their stand, at the mine entrances.
It was hard to tell from the overlook at the lower interior gates to the Undercity.
But it seemed like pockets of Kadrins might even have been surrendering. Brannis ran. Brannis tried to run, but managed to hustle. His back hurt, and his left arm was likely broken. The enchantment on the armor had saved his life, but it was done saving him until a sorcerer saw to it.
I guess I should be glad the Quicksilver stays solid when it runs out of ether, Brannis mused, mid-hustle.
When he got to the ogre cages, he found them in a highly agitated mood. They strode over to the barred door that marked the entrance to their little community.
Who is your leader? Brannis demanded.
From what he knew of ogres, they dealt in strength, using simple, straightforward chains of command that were often topped by the strongest warrior. He hoped these were at least sensible enough to follow someone who spoke good Kadrin.
That'd be me, one near the door answered.
The ogre towered over Brannis the way he did over Iridan. Brannis's bloody face came to the ogre's sternum, so he had to look up to see the furrowed brow and suspicious glare the ogre met him with.
What is your name? Brannis asked.
He refused to treat them with the dishonor that the nobles of Rainsdark did. He wanted them to fight for him, not as slaves, but as warriors. He hoped that the instinct for it still lurked behind the docile front they had showed so far. The cunning he saw in their leader's gaze gave him some hope.
Me Glumg, who you?
The ogre responded. I am Sir Brannis Solaran. I lead the Kadrin army. I am the big boss. I am boss of all bosses. I want you to fight for me. Brannis gestured to all of the ogres in the pen. There were hundreds of them, and most would be battle-ready without training if the opponents were just measly little goblins. All of you.
Huh? You have us fight goblins? They everywhere. See 'em?
Glumg pointed out into the city.
So what? You were ogres. You were a lot bigger.
step on them, kick them, hit them with tools. Killing goblins is easy. There are a lot of them to kill, Brannis said. And it is fun. You will like killing goblins. They make a crunch noise when you step on them. Brannis mimicked a crunching sound as best he could. It was a skill all little boys learned at an early age, and he got the point across. Glum grinned.
But goblin give us gold. Say you give us weapons to fight goblins. We fight humans instead, Glum said.
Brannis was impressed at the point he was managing to convey. The goblins paid the ogres off? So it would seem.
I make you a better offer. You fight for me, you get freedom. You fight for me, kill goblins.
I make you free.
No more cages. You get paid for working, same as humans. You work, you get gold. You buy things you like. You come and go when it is not work time. Free, Brannis promised.
Duke Peloton hates me anyway. If he still has a city left in the morning, he will be needing more than just slaves to populate it.
Deal,
Glum decided,
after a moment's pondering with his chin cupped in one massive hand. Deal. Brannis removed his gauntlets and extended a hand through the bars. Glum had seen the human custom of clasping hands and tried it for the first time. Brannis's hand was engulfed in a stone-like grip of Glumg, and they made their deal on the custom of free men.
Juliana, burn through the hinges, Brannis said over his shoulder.
He had not watched her sneak up behind him, but he had caught Glum's gaze flicking over to her on occasion, and he had assumed she would follow him anyway.
Kotho elextiumain viru, Brannis heard from just behind him.
He smiled with amusement that he had outguessed her for once. The hinges glowed red and soft. Putting his gauntlets back on, he reached out with his good hand, grabbed the door not far from the hinge, and heaved. The weakened metal gave way, and he stumbled back with the door in his grasp. Not trying to balance the heavy and awkward piece of iron, he turned and let it fall away. He hoped the display was impressive enough for his new allies to respect his strength.
Kathoom!
Brannis turned at the sound.
That did not sound right. The cannons were buried under the falling glacier. And if they had others out there, the snow and rock would have muffled the sound almost completely. Where is that sound coming from?
Hey, everybody. We go and do kill goblins. All goblins. Big boss say it gonna be fun,
Glum shouted back, beckoning his fellows with a great sweeping gesture, and the leader of the captive ogres strode past Brannis out into the Undercity. Brannis jogged through the city, Juliana in tow, looking for someone knowledgeable to ask. He had a suspicion about where the sound of cannon fire could be coming from. He had not seen Jinzan on the battlefield, and he had begun to suspect the sorcerer wished to use those cannons to destroy Galen's obelisk and sabotage the city. The plan seemed overly complex, especially if, as Minon claimed, stopping the obelisk's function would have no immediate effect on the city. He needed to find out where the echoes were emanating from, though. That would tell him what he needed to know. The front lines of the running battle were impossible to define. The goblins were cut off from their senior commanders, and their organized charges and flanking maneuvers from the battle for the Overcity were gone, replaced by small roving bands of 20 to 50 goblins that were operating under lesser-ranked commanders. Brannis and Juliana avoided one such band and sent another scattering. They recognized Brannis and wanted no part of him, disengaging as quickly as they found and attacked them. At length, Brannis found Minon, protected by a regiment of his father's personal guards, near the Undercity entrance to the castle. Brannis gave him credit for getting within sight of the battle, even if his men's posture was strictly defensive.
Where's that noise coming from? Brannis asked.
Twice more they had heard the cannon fire, and with no clearer understanding of whence the noise came.
Could we be hearing it from the upper mines?
Quite possibly.
There is a cross-link between the upper and lower mines from one of the earlier horizontal shafts. The way between is boarded up, but sound certainly travels down from the upper mines when we have men working up there, Minon replied. I thought you said the upper mines were abandoned, Brannis said. As mines, yes, but we use the old mine shafts for storage now. There is far more space than we would ever need, and the castle is not so large that the extra storage is wasted, Minon said. What is the quickest way there? Brannis asked. Through the castle. There is an entrance from the kitchens, cut through into the old mines to use for dry goods and wines, Minon replied. Lead the way, all of you, Brannis said, gesturing to the Duke's guards. Are coming with me. There is a sorcerer in those mines, and we have to stop him. Jinzan swept away chunks of stone from the base of the obelisk with a bristle broom he had found within the warren of tunnels that constituted the upper mines. The Cadrans had apparently been using the abandoned shaft as a dumping ground for all manner of excess supplies. Barrels, nails, iron ingots, old books, horse tack, cured meats, and anything else they did not wish to store elsewhere. It had taken him far too long to find his way through it, much of the wasted time coming when he had to climb over clutter and push things out of his way. He was thankful that the cannon had been miniaturized, or he would have been delayed far longer maneuvering it through the mess in the mines. The cannon and its accessories were back to their normal size now. Jinzan had managed the enlargement as deftly as he had shrunken them in the first place, and he could detect no flaws in the aspect of them. The cannon now was set facing the obelisk from a dozen paces away at the entrance to the obelisk chamber. The chamber was a dead end in the mines, a widened area with one entrance and a rather suspect exit. It had an exposed view of the conduit of the volcano. If it were to ever erupt, the lava would rise through that very same vertical shaft. The obelisk was a genius work of ward crafting. Half again the height of a man and shoulder width on each side. Every bit of it was covered in a single intricate ward, with numerous functions all mingled into its web of runes. It drew ether in from all about it. Jinzan could approach no closer than a pace without feeling deathly ill, and even 3 paces away was uncomfortable, and it undid all magics that approached too close to it. It was formed of a light gray stone that was unfamiliar to Jinzan and was not native to the cloud wall. His first few shots had been promising, but the broken pieces the cannonballs blasted free had slid slowly back toward the rest of the ward and reformed themselves. Jinzan had tried to keep ahead of it, hoping to shatter the ward through force faster than it could repair itself. But alone, he could not clean, load, and fire the cannon fast enough, even using telekinesis to do all the hard work. He had gone back into the mines to find the broom at that point. Now, after each blast, he approached as near as he could and reached out with the broom to brush away the loose pieces. If he moved them beyond 5 paces or so from the obelisk,
they no longer tried to rejoin the rest.
It is only a matter of time now, Jinzan grinned.
Kathoom!
Jinzan fired again, and the cannonball cracked a large chunk free from one corner. The heavy iron sphere ricocheted off and through the archway that led off into the nothingness of the volcano's conduit. Runes were carved all along the archway, even along the floor from one side to the other, forming a ward that prevented the toxic fumes of the deep earth from wafting up into the inhabited portion of the mines.
The obelisk seemed not to hinder those wards,
despite their proximity. Jinzan suspected they might be somehow linked. The fallen chunk of rock was too heavy to yield to the broom's bristles, so Jinzan picked up one of the cannonballs in his hand. Using telekinesis yet again, he threw the ball at the loose piece of the obelisk, releasing the magic before the ward stole the ether from him. Crack! The rock split, but both of the 2 largest chunks, along with the cannonball, went down the shaft as well, into the vast depths whence came a faint red glow. Back to his work, Jinzan loaded the cannon again, impatience making him forget to clean the gun before firing it again.
Ka-thoom!
Another huge chunk fell loose and did not seem to move thereafter. Jinzan's eyes lit. He saw it then, a glint of white wood, the core of the obelisk, the staff of Galen. Jinzan realized that he had finally done enough to the ward that it no longer drew against him. He inched carefully closer and discovered to his glee that there was no further effect on him. Jinzan drew up a reserve of ether and prepared to free the staff from its stony prison the way he knew best, with magic.
It's mine!
Ka-thoom!
Brannis, Juliana,
and 12 of the Duke's guards hustled down the passages of the mine,
pausing to recheck their bearings each time they heard the cannon fire. They were growing close. When they had arrived at the kitchen entrance to the mines, Brannis had picked out the dozen men he had taken, and Juliana had taken advantage of the pause to reinfuse his armor with ether, hopefully enough to protect him in the event that they managed to find the Magrin sorcerer and engage him in combat.
There ought to be a crew of 4 or 5 goblins working the cannon. This should be more than enough men to deal with them.
Brannis had also traded his spear for a sword from one of the guards he left to defend Minan. There were only so many men left that could travel swiftly together through the mines, and 12 was already stretching it.
This way, Brannis whispered urgently after the most recent report.
The group took a left at the next intersection they came to, based on Brannis's hearing of the noise.
Ka-thoom!
There had been little pause that time between blasts.
Not good. They are rushing. Either they know they are being pursued, or they are eager about something. Neither option bodes well for us.
Despite their attempts at swift stealth, a group of 14, mostly in armor, could not avoid detection for long. That last blast had been close, and Brannis increased his pace, wincing at each step as his injured arm was jolted. The time for quiet was over, though, and the chase was on.
Boom!
There was a great explosion, followed by a clatter of rock. It sounded distinctly different from the sharp report of the cannons. It sounded like destructive magic. It had come from just ahead and around the corner. Brannis led the way and stopped short when, from a dozen paces away, he saw the Magrin sorcerer standing before an archway that was lit from the far side with a red glow. The sorcerer was a ghost from another world. It was Denric Zane, younger looking perhaps, and sporting longer hair, but definitely the pirate he had come to know. In his hands, he was holding a long white staff,
topped with a pair of stylized wooden wings,
cut at sharp angles.
Kyrus!
Jinzan gasped, eyes wide in shock. The staff leveled toward him.
Stay back!
Hello, Captain Zane, Brannis replied evenly, smirking. You are caught. There is no escape now. Drop the staff and surrender, and I shall guarantee your safety.
Kyrus, you are not lying after all. You are just a brigand.
No, I think I shall not surrender. With the staff of Galen, I can fight my way out now, Jinzan said. The sorcerer seemed much the same man Kyrus knew from Tellurak. Perhaps a bit less reserved, but the voice, the manner, everything seemed to Brannis that this was Denric dressed for a masquerade.
Not with the demon warlock outside. He would never let you escape, and I do not think it would be wise to draw against him, Brannis said.
His companions seemed ill-inclined to move past him toward the Magrin sorcerer their grand marshal had parleyed with.
The only deal I will make is this. I will spare your life here, and you will spare me there. Understood?
I know my predicament all too well now, Jinzan bargained. We can discuss this later, but for now...
Fetru Oglo Dexkag Sev Duinlu, Jinzan began, leveling the staff at Brannis and his companions.
Brannis reacted instinctively. He did not recognize the spell, but he understood Jinzan's intent all too clearly. He dove and drove Juliana to the ground an instant before the air erupted in lightning. He heard the sizzle of flesh and felt a tingle along his back where the armor was probably saving him from a similar fate. He checked to see that Juliana was untouched by the lightning, and then turned to see what Jinzan was doing as the Duke's guards fell dead about him. Brennus saw nothing but an opaque sphere around where Captain Zane's counterpart had just been. He heard indistinguishable mutterings from within, and for the first time in his life, Brennus felt the flow of the ether, this time as it was drawn inward toward that same sphere. Juliana stirred beneath him in obvious distress. Brennus worried that whatever was happening was about to kill her as well. Then it ended. Jinzan was gone, as was a curved scoop of stone from the mine floor. In its place was gently turned soil and a few flowers.